some notes about the exchange rate of the dollar. Is one of the targets or not appropriate?
So the FOMC, your question is, how is the FOMC looking at the exchange rate for the dollar? The FOMC looks at the exchange rate of the dollars. It does many economic variables and is not targeting the dollar. We leave that to the Treasury. So we are looking at the factors that Congress has mandated for us, and that is primarily looking to the long run for sustained growth in this economy by looking at price stability and looking at how we can maximize employment in the process of doing that. Now, I will say, excuse me?
The market will take care.
The market will take care of it, I believe.
Okay. Kathleen's right behind Parliament.
Hi, President George. The conference is America First, and so we're going to be talking about Trump's fiscal policy, however it unfolds. But is the assumption of the Fed that there will be a fiscal boost to aggregate demand, and therefore that inflation that we're talking about, there's a risk of it accelerating with aggregate demand exceeding what the economy can handle, if that's correct? And then two, do you see any scenario where this could provide a jolt, say, to R-star and lift the neutral rate and give the Fed some breathing room?
So trying to gauge the impact of fiscal policy, as you know, is a challenge right now. And so in my own forecast, have not incorporated that without seeing exactly. Like others, though, as I noted, seeing where the risk to the outlook might be, I would say that poses a potential upside risk. We could see faster growth than has been forecast. We could see inflation moving higher. But that, I think, suggests steady as we go in the as the economy stands today, and we'll see how that unfolds. Those policies will be important. They will be consequential one way or the other in how that unfolds. To the point of will it raise what we believe to be the neutral long-run rate for Fed funds, I suspect that that could be a component of that. You know, that has dominated a great deal of discussion, trying to figure out where are we headed. Has that number come down relative to where it was? And I think you see in those summary of economic projections, there has been a downshift in looking at that longer run measure. Whether we have permanently reached that state, I don't know. I think we'll have to see if the economy actually can pick up relative to that trend rate of growth we've seen, that may in fact boost what that longer run R-star looks like. So.
Stephanie?
I wanted to read you a quote that I ran across just yesterday. It's from Hyman Minsky's own work. And in the context of discussions about unwinding the Fed's balance sheet, I just wondered if you could tell us to what extent, if any, considerations like these are things that the FOMC thinks about. So what Minsky wrote is this: if we consolidate the books of all of the government agencies, then the Treasury debt held by the Federal Reserve banks would appear as both an asset and a liability of the government. Such internal financial arrangements are usually ignored, but the debt, to all practical purposes, does disappear once it enters the Federal Reserve's portfolio. So when you think about unwinding, for all intents and purposes, once the Fed buys the bonds, it's as if the Treasury never issued them in the first place, right, is the point that Minsky's making. So could you talk a little bit about to what extent you all think about this in terms of debt management and fiscal? Yeah.
So the size of the balance sheet today, and I think as you think about consolidating the books of the Federal Reserve with the federal government, absolutely, in accounting sense, that's what happens. You see that that is not of consequence to the taxpayer as a whole, how we think about the debt more generally. Remember, though, the objective of the central bank in undertaking these actions was to affect market functioning in some way. It was to pull out those safe assets, and the objective was to create what some called a wealth effect, was to create more risk-taking, in the markets by virtue of fact that you would create scarcity with those safe assets. And I think some would argue that's happened. We saw housing values begin to turn around and rise. In my part of the country, you saw farmland begin to take a quick step up, notwithstanding the rise in commodity prices. We've seen equity prices move up. So to the extent that that was the objective, I think some would say we've seen that play out. The reason I talk about not will it settle out in terms of an accounting sense of offsetting, but that unwind then is open to this debate that you see we're having about what will be the implications. Is going in the same as the coming out? Will the pulling those safe assets out of the market to force risk then cause an unwinding of risk in some way as you see that go? And so I think for myself, I don't think we can know. I think the honest answer is moving slowly to see how markets react to that is important. I do think, though, a central bank with a smaller footprint, and you will see this in some of the FOMC's earlier communications, returning to a smaller footprint, only a balance sheet that's as large as needed to conduct more conventional types of policy is where we should be headed. That, of course, and that timeline could be a long one.
Yes, my question is with regard to the Fed's balance sheet. Do you have a professional preference on how it should be done? Should it be done through an active open market operation sale of the securities, or let the securities retire? And related to that is, depending on which method you use, is there a difference in terms of the efficacy of monetary policy?
So that question is very core to the discussion. So my own preference, and again, the committee has had this conversation for some time. I was not particularly in favor of foreclosing the option of sales, but the committee has said in its normalization principles that it does not anticipate sales other than what it might take. So the focus is on what happens with those maturing securities. And will you cease those reinvestments? Will you try to smooth them? So if you look at the maturity schedule in that portfolio, you will see it looks a little choppy. My own preference would be to start the process, indicate how we will smooth that in some way. I think that makes sense. Some months you see a fair amount of those bonds maturing. We also know as rates rise, those mortgage-backed securities are not likely to prepay in the way they had. That duration may extend. So I think we're going to have more conversations about how that works, but I do favor a smooth and a gradual process, and then once we set it, let that work in the background and go about focusing on how short-term rates should be adjusted relative to the economy.
Thank you. You talked about the importance of looking at the market's reaction to changes in the balance sheet. There was even concern that when the Fed even began to speak about changing, that the market might react. But it appears that the discussion over the last few weeks didn't cause that as the minutes came out and such. So I'm wondering how you interpret the market's non-reaction. And then second, I know you don't want to pay attention to one specific economic detail, but the latest CPI data was shocking to me in the sense of it was the first time the core CPI was actually down in quite a long period of time. At what point, if we got a second or a third one like that, would you say, oh my God, we're having a risk of deflation again?
Right. So to your first point about why the markets haven't reacted, I'll chalk that up to excellent communications from the Fed. I don't know. I think the Federal Reserve has tried to communicate clearly, and the idea of reaffirming its exit strategy principles back in 2014, from time to time revisiting those, I think has been an attempt to try to be very public, to try to communicate about what might happen. So we'll see. I don't take that for granted. Maybe the markets are waiting to see further information, how much detail, And as the committee talks about this, obviously more of that information will be forthcoming. Your second question about the CPI numbers. So you're right, my answer is going to be always cautious about reacting to a single data point. I'll give you an example, though, of how I think about it in my job as a regional Fed president. So watching that data tells me something happened over my shoulder, something in the past. And so engaging with the public, and I do that by visiting with labor groups, with community groups, with businesses in my region to say, tell me what you see going forward, because businesses are having to make decisions today for 6 months, 12 months out. That context is important in trying to understand, is that number something that suggests to me there's a turning point in the economy? Does it suggest, again, it's a blip and, you know, I'll need to see the second and third iterations of that? And I tend to look at it more in that way. So I never ignore a single data point. You can't do that. But you do have to understand what might be driving that. And if it's not clear, if it's not clear to you that this is the beginning of a turn, then this process of waiting for additional information can be important. What I'm cautious about as it relates to our policy choices, and we've had this experience over the last 4 or 5 years, and we see it again this first quarter, for example, we see growth softening. And so as you look back to say this has been a pattern, we've seen first quarter soften and a bounce back in the second quarter, can we look through it? And that is probably the most difficult and challenging thing, I think, for a policymaker, is to keep an eye on the long run while trying to take in the signals that are happening today.
During your talk, you mentioned that while CPI was at a level about, while inflation was at about 2%, there were certain subsectors where it was far higher. The failure to anticipate the great financial crisis can partially be attributed to looking at overly consolidated sectors, where though a sector as a whole might be performing fine, there were subsectors that had very unhealthy balance sheets. And I was wondering what steps the Federal Reserve is taking in general to look at the more pertinent subsectors rather than these consolidated balance sheets that don't say much of anything.
So you raise a very important point, which is aggregate numbers, aggregate measures tell you something, and they're generally our best proxy for what the Federal Reserve has to be thinking about, and that is not specific sectors. We cannot channel and should not be channeling specific sectors of the economy. So aggregate measures are our best proxy to do that. But you raise a very important point, which is not understanding what underlies those measures can be an Achilles heel. And one of those was a buildup in leverage, issues in the mortgage market, which today I think remain with us. Housing has not come back in the way that we might like to see it, given its importance to the economy. So it is the job of the policymaker to look carefully at what some call the micro data to understand, again, as I just said, what is building up to those aggregates. In a regulatory sense, the Federal Reserve has an important job, and I think the theme of this conference around financial stability is something that policymakers worldwide have begun to pay more attention to say there is an interplay. It doesn't do us any good to focus singularly on inflation and unemployment if the financial system itself is not stable. And so has put more attention on regulating and supervising the financial institutions. It has meant that we talk about that more holistically, and you will see that in FOMC minutes, the discussion of financial stability factors across many aspects of the economy to try to understand that. I will just close, though, with this. And again, this comes from my experience over several decades of supervising financial institutions. When you set conditions for risk, you are asking regulators to do more than I think is reasonable, to try to stop that, to try to balance that relative to those incentives. So it all works together, and making sure that you are looking across those parts carefully is important, as you note.
President George, thank you for being here today. And my question would be, given that the Fed is planning on normalizing the size of the balance sheet, former Chairman Bernanke last year exposed for the Brookings Institute the benefits of the overnight reverse repo, as well as the interest on excess reserves to maintain a certain level of stability within the financial system. So my question would be then, if we are to normalize the size of the balance sheet, is that to pre-recession levels, or is that to a certain new level to maintain these two mechanisms?
So the mechanism that the Federal Reserve is using, and you referred to the overnight reverse repo, is a function of the large balance sheet and the fact that there are so many reserves in the banking system that you don't have the scarcity of reserves to move the interest rate. So today the Federal Reserve has several rates it is targeting. It has interest on excess reserves. It has the overnight reverse repo, which serves as a sort of floor to that federal funds target rate. If you are to get back, though, to what the committee has said, and that is a smaller footprint, a balance sheet that is no larger than needed, yes, the balance sheet will be larger than when we went into the crisis. The economy has grown, and I suspect you will see a larger balance sheet, but it won't be $4.5 trillion, I doubt, and that will be, again, the challenge of the committee and its analysis to say what is that longer run framework that will allow the Federal Reserve to conduct its policy in the least disruptive manner that intervenes in markets only to the extent that it needs to. And that is where the committee is trying to get back to. The path along the way, as I noted here, is one that we will have to tread carefully and to continue to look at the outcomes we're getting in the economy.
Okay, if there are no more questions, I'm going to abuse my position as chair to ask to pick up on what I thought was a very interesting point about the use of the size of the balance sheet as a short-term policy tool. Mm-hmm. Now, if we go, as I say to my daughter, a long, long time ago, there was a time when the Federal Reserve did, in fact, target or intervene at the long end of the curve. And there was a decision taken to suspend that policy and to move to emphasis on short-term rates and effectively eventually to the policy that we now have. Now, if we look at QE, basically a QE was an attempt to influence the yield curve, and it was pretty straightforward what the Fed was attempting to do. So my question is, I quite understand that it's perfectly inappropriate to think about the size of the balance sheet as a short-term policy tool. I think just in terms of operations, this would be impossible. But does this also mean that the Fed is, again, going back to the old position of leaving the longer end of the yield curve to be determined by the market?
Well, implicitly, I think that's the case, unless there is a change in the long-run framework that the committee uses. And you would have seen several meetings ago a discussion about, last year the staff did a fair amount of work on thinking about what is the appropriate longer-run framework for monetary policy. If decisions are made to change that, you may find the committee targeting a different regime than it has been. But today, the approach we're taking is one that expects the movement in that short-term rate is going to set the path of interest rates. That's a challenge to know with this balance sheet when you're trying to do both ends of the curve. And I will hear people express their concerns about what that will mean. So this is an experiment that we are moving out of, and I think have not foreclosed thinking about what that long-run framework should be, as you know.
Okay, well, before we take this question, I'll ask the additional question that I had in mind. I note that you are leading the responsibility of the Fed in modernizing the U.S. payment system. And this is slightly off track from what we're thinking about,
relevant,
but something which is of great interest to me in particular. So if you could just be able to give us some indication of what the Fed views the rise of alternative mobile payment systems and things of that sort.
Yeah, happy to address that. This is an initiative the Federal Reserve undertook a couple of years ago with a paper that talked about strategies for modernizing the U.S. payment system. The reason the Federal Reserve initiated this work was looking at the role that technology is playing in the economy today. It is quite natural today for people to do commerce by internet. That is to get on their laptops, whether you're an individual or a business, and conduct commerce. And so making payments in a similar fashion was becoming increasingly demanded, and the demand for those payments were increasingly being met by non-bank entities, those outside what we've come to know as being a special role, if you will, something Jerry Corrigan used to refer to, our bank special. He saw that connection to the payment system and a regulated entity being a component of the public's trust in the system for those payments. And the question is, this payment system is beginning to develop in a way that is fragmented. It is not an end-to-end sort of ability to transact payments. And we felt both on the technology side, the marketplace is going to respond to that, but on the security side, it was essential that the public's trust in that payment system not be compromised. And so the effort has been over the last 2 years to convene many, many players in that payment system. The traditional banks are at the table. We have consumer groups at the table. The merchants are there. The network providers, those innovators from Silicon Valley and other parts of the country, sitting at the table to say, what would a faster payment in the United States look like? How would it be governed? What rules need to be adjusted relative to some of the legacy payments we have in this country? And this summer, we expect that that task force will issue its report that will talk about what the prospects are of achieving the kind of system in the United States that will serve us well, to think about some of the issues that we know have come out of other emerging networks over time. So this is an important component. People ask, is our involvement a way to limit innovation, to push against things like bitcoins and digital currencies? And it's not at all the case. It is really one to say, this country has always built off of its legacy systems. So we continue to issue a lot of cash. People find cash to be a relevant payment form. But they are also increasingly wanting to use their mobile phones to make those payments. And so we look forward to that task force report this summer coming out. It will then be an opportunity for the Federal Reserve to respond to that relative to those desired outcomes we were looking for in the paper 2 years ago.
One more question.
Thank you. At a time where some companies are reportedly finding it hard to find qualified employees, at a time where the unemployment rate is seemingly near target, but the proportion of people who are employed, the participation rate, is relatively low, where long-term unemployment has, for some people, been a real problem. So we've gone through something different over the recovery, the period of years over the recovery from the global financial crisis. How do you put all of these things into the soup to think about them?
It's a very good question. So the labor market has lots of moving parts too, as we talked about earlier. In fact, my staff in Kansas City have put together a labor market index to try to judge some 24 different variables to say how should we be thinking about the health of that labor market versus the level of employment versus the momentum with which jobs are coming online. If there's one issue, though, I hear consistently in my region, and my guess is around the country more generally, is how important the workforce and its skills will be to the future economy. And that future economy we're beginning to see unfold today, where the kinds of skills that are in demand seem to be in short supply. And so policies that will aim at trying to make sure that that workforce grows and it grows in a way that can meet the needs of the economy is going to be critical. That, of course, is beyond the reach of monetary policy to solve, but I'm no less interested in how those policies unfold. When I go around my region, I will hear we are short of skilled labor, people that can weld, people that can work in construction. We are short of skills for any number of kinds of jobs today. I visited a company last week that pointed out how many jobs they had on their payroll today that didn't exist 2 years ago. So these are jobs that had replaced some, but now we're requiring higher skills. I'm also encouraged when I go around my region and see colleges, to see elementary schools, high schools that are beginning to think about this issue and beginning to think about how to work with young people to understand what their choices are and how to encourage those relative to the economy that we see unfolding. So very important issue, I think, for the future. Thank you very much.